This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jam on the Groove is a hip-hop review nearing the end of an off-Broadway run that will tour in the fall. My guest is one of the dancers, Adesola Osokolumi, also known as Dee Incredible. He grew up in the Bronx, where he learned the moves from some of the pioneers of breakdancing in the early 80s. He was a founding member of the Rhythm Technicians, which recently teamed up with other dancers, including members of the Rock Steady Crew and Magnificent Force, to form the company Get Original Productions. He started dancing in jams at schoolyards and clubs, but he's since danced around the world, as well as at the Kennedy Center, Lincoln Center, and on music videos. I asked Osokolumi to describe the basic moves of hip-hop dancing.
We have b-boying, which most people know as breakdancing. Breakdancing was a term that we never started. It was more of a media terminology. B-boying is the breaking of what's done on the floor. And a quick definition of the B, a B refers to the break of a record, which is, you know, the percussive part of the record that the DJs would spin back and forth, extending it. And to that part of the music, the guys would go down on the floor. So you have b-boying, you know, the footwork, the head spins, the back spins, all the physical moves. You have popping, which is a form that began in the West Coast. Popping is basically muscle contraction and release. Contracting your muscles, releasing your muscles, incorporates a lot of illusions, waves, the moonwalk, which people are very familiar with, but the moonwalk is just one move in a series of moves called floats. You have forward moonwalk, you have a backward moonwalk, you have a side moonwalk, etc. And then you have locking. Locking consists of wrist rolls, points. Some people make the similarity or make the comparison to jazz. They even call it super jazz. It's a very character-filled dance form with a lot of energy. So you basically have popping, locking, and b-boying. Those three forms.
My impression is that not many people are breakdancing or, you know, doing this kind of hip-hop dancing anymore. That it was much more popular in the late 70s and early 80s than it is now. Is that true?
To an extent, yes, but I think on a larger level, no. I'll deal with America first. When breaking and popping and locking within its commercial heyday, of course, everyone did it. You saw it everywhere. It became a media event. You saw commercials. I mean,
exactly. They're doing it on right, hamburger commercials, right, as well,
exactly,
as on the street. Yeah.
I mean, I did a Levi's 501 jeans commercial myself. But what did happen was you had a lot of choreographers, and a lot of dancers, a lot of pop artists who saw the dance had energy, who saw it was something new. We feel it was something that came along to nurture the dance world. So maybe you didn't see the movements done in their full form, but many dancers, many choreographers incorporated elements of what we do in their videos. I mean, from, you know, Paula Abdul to Michael Jackson to Janet Jackson. Now, in America, it's become a part of dance. I mean, we've been in dance classes and dance studios, working with people, you know, checking stuff out, and people always are asking, how do you do that? How can we incorporate that into what we do?
Now tell me, I this might be a misperception, but
okay.
It seems to me that earlier in rap, that rap groups would often have dancers with them, and then that maybe when gangster rap came along, that association ended a little bit, and that the gangster rapper's attitude wasn't about dancing.
I think that's basically true. Again, when hip-hop first began, you had four basic elements, the four main elements that formed hip-hop culture. You had the dancing, you had the MC on the mic, which we call them MCs, not rappers, but, you know, the term is, the meaning is still the same, the person who was verbally exciting the crowd. You had the DJ. His responsibility was to set the musical undertone, the musical backbone, and you had the graffiti artist. When rap first started, when hip-hop first started, at jams, outdoor block parties and stuff, you had the DJ, you had the MC, and then you had the dancers in front. The MC's job was like, he was like the storyteller, the modern day poet who got the dancers hyped. Then the dancers came on and were on equal footing with the MC. As the music industry got involved, it became more of a money making thing. Definitely, you had the rappers being put to the forefront, the dancers being put to the back. Now, as far as gangster rap goes, of course, all rap and all MCing is storytelling. So a lot of the stories that the gangster rappers are telling don't necessitate dance. because they're not really talking about things that are happy and dance-oriented. So by virtue of that, you definitely see less dancers as the industry has sort of embraced gangster rap. And by embraced, I mean not that people love it or agree with it, but in terms of it being the most popular, bringing in the most revenue, it definitely has been embraced.
Now, do you remember the first time that you saw breakdancing and popping and locking?
Yep. Yeah. I had a friend of mine named Charlie Beats, as he's now known. He's in the music business. You know, the area in the Bronx I lived in was a lot, sort of like a hotbed for popping and locking. A lot of great poppers and a lot of great dancers were in that area. So it wasn't like you had to go search for it. You look out your window in the summer, you see somebody on the corner just, you know, hanging out in the schoolyard, just working out with a box, just practicing. So I saw my friend Charles doing a wave. And I was like, yo, Charles, what was that? You got it. I was fascinated. It was something I had never seen before. It was like magical. It was like I had seen magic. And from that point on, I was attracted to it. Now, before I saw it live, definitely I saw it on Soul Train and saw other dancers who were doing it long before. But seeing it live was just, it took it to another level. It made it tangible because it was right there in front of me.
So how did you start to learn this? Did you get anybody to teach you? Did you just work on it yourself?
Okay. Well, like I said, I saw a lot of people doing it, and it was a matter of, at first, learning from watching people, trying to pick up what they did, because when I first started in the area I started in, if you weren't that good, it was difficult to get people to work with you. It was almost like being an apprentice and saying, excuse me, can you teach me? Like, nah, get out of here, you know, come back in, I don't know, you got to come back and show me something better. So initially, it was kind of difficult getting people to show me because they only wanted to, I guess, work with people who were, you know, pretty good. But I continued trying to get better and better. And then I had another friend named Rodney, an incredible dancer, incredible popper and locker, and his brother Chris. And they actually, you know, would begin to show me certain moves. This is how you do a wave. This is how you do a hit. This is how we create movement, blah, 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 blah. And at that point, once I started, you know, actually having stuff explained to me, it became much easier, obviously.
Now, what about the stuff that always looks the most difficult, like spinning on your head and spinning on your back? How'd you learn that stuff?
Well, see, that's a good question, because primarily I'm more of a popper and locker. I do some floor movement, but I'm not a b-boy. But I will tell you, from speaking to b-boys that I know and people I work very closely with, like Ken Swift, like Quick Step, like Legs, a lot of b-boys in our company, first of all, everything that we do involves an incredible amount of practice and determination because, again, there's no formal school for it. So a lot of it is a person's really personal drive. As far as spinning on your head goes, I know I've spoken to people, and it is something that you work up to in small increments. It is not easy. You first have to know how to balance on your head and then tap, just do a few taps and go around, and it takes a lot of hard work, and it takes a lot of courage, because
yeah,
getting on your head and attempting to spin even for a quarter of a revolution is frightening. And yes, it can be dangerous if you don't know what you're doing, but hopefully anyone who wants to spin on their head would have someone who's breaking it down for them, showing them what to do, what not to do, where their body should be placed. It's almost like a reverse pirouette when you're on your toe and you're lifting up. Mm-hmm. If you can think of being on your head and lifting up against gravity, it's deep.
How do you create a combination of moves?
In popping and locking especially, you always take a move, let's take a basic move, and then you try to build on it, which is how you create your combinations, which is how you create your big battle moves or your big showstopper moves. Let's say you're just taking a wave, right? I'm throwing a wave from my right hand, up, you know, through my shoulder, roll it around my chest, and throw it out my left hand. Okay, that's a wave. Okay, I got a wave now. So, well, I need to do something different. Okay, maybe now, rather than throwing from right hand to left hand, I'll throw it to my right hand. When it gets to my shoulder, I'll put it in my chest, and then I'll hit, pop. I'll pop it there. Then I'll break it down, and a fast wave, a body wave, down into my foot, and hit again when it gets to my leg. So now the visual has gone from my arm to chest, down to my body, down to my foot. Then I'll take my right hand. Now I want to move the wave, but with my foot. So I'll take my right hand and do heel toe, heel toe, heel toe, move my heel and with the hand, like the hand is controlling the toe, almost like a marionette. Move it out, bow, hit it, move it back to where it originally started, then bring it back up through my body and then out through my left hand. So rather than throw it from right to left, I took it from right into chest, hit, waved it down to my foot, hit again, made it wiggle to the right, wiggled it back to the beginning position, waved it back up the body from the foot, through the hips, through the stomach, through the chest, out through the left arm, boom, and hit it out again. So rather than just take a wave and go right to left, I took it from like A to B and I added C, D, E, F, G along the line. And that's how I create combinations.
My guest is Adesola Osokolumi, one of the dancers in the Off-Broadway hip-hop review Jam on the Groove. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Adesola Osokolumi, we're talking about hip-hop dancing. When you started getting your moves down, mm-hmm. what kind of places would you dance? Clubs, schoolyards? What were the different options for you?
Okay. The different options that existed were definitely schoolyards. You know, this was a dance that was a communal. You go out, and if there was a jam was a big outdoor party, be it in a schoolyard, be it in a park, be it in a community room, definitely at clubs, definitely at house parties. House parties was where a lot of things happened. Clubs also. Personally, when I first started dancing and learning this dance, I was in high school. I was in a private high school. So I was like, as we say, under lock and key. I wasn't allowed really to go out to clubs. So initially, clubs were not even a possibility for me. I did most of my like development and practicing in my room. That might sound funny, but I did a lot of stuff in my room to the extent my mom be like, look, knock, knock, knock. Stop. Will you stop that? Turn the music down. It was that type of thing. Now, when I got out of high school and got into college, then I became party man. I went out a lot. I went out a lot because one thing about going out to clubs, as any dancer will tell you, you know, if you dance just in your room or just with your boys around your block or around your neighborhood, you will get good, but you'll be limited because you won't see a diversity. You won't see a wide range. So after a while, you begin seeing the same movement, same people, and it can become a little limiting. But going out to clubs, you see people from Brooklyn with their moves and Queens and their style. You see people who dance differently, have different body forms, and that's when you really start learning because that's when your reputation is on the line nightly when you're in a club.
In the early days, was dancing for you very competitive? Were there different groups that would compete with each other?
Oh, definitely. Again, this dance is very competitive. That's where I think you saw the energy. What people mistook as violence was just competitive energy. It was like it's like football. It was like musical football without teams. Just one person going against another person. When I was starting out, again, I did a lot of stuff by myself, but there were definitely crews and there were definitely battles. The best thing, the most exciting thing was either going to a party and knowing so-and-so is going to battle so-and-so because he thinks he's better, or this group is going to battle this group. And that was definitely how a reality, a fact of life, battles.
What was a battle like and who decided who won?
Okay. Good. Okay. A battle could happen, first of all, at any time or any place where you had two dancers. Someone, let's say you're in a club, right? Say back in the days, people were at the Roxy. A guy's dancing. And he's, you know, doing his thing. And maybe he did a move that he really liked. And he's smiling. He's like, yeah, that was fresh. I killed it. That was dope. That was all that, right? Another person might say, who does he think he is? I'm going to go battle him. The person, you could just walk up to a person and say, yo, what's up? Put your hands up. Or just look at him. Or just do a move. This is how really a lot of battles started. You just do a move and stare at the person, like calling him out. Battles could start like that. Who decided the winner would basically be the audience? Now, of course, if a person had more of his friends in the audience, they could make more noise,
right.
You know. But really, battles were pretty fair. Even if a person had all of his boys there, you could tell really who was getting roasted, who was going to win or lose. Just by, you know, if someone started repeating their movements, you saw, well, this person's running out of moves. That was grounds to lose right there. Or if someone, you know, some people would battle on a technical level, do a lot of technical, highly complex combinations, right? Another person who maybe wouldn't be as good technically would battle with a clown attitude. He tried to get the audience to laugh at the person. So a person can be doing all these great combinations, killing themselves. The other guy come up, do a move, do something, make everyone laugh. So there were different ways to get around lack of technique or lack of skill. It was really a personal test. So everything, you had to use your character, your crowd-pleasing abilities, as well as your actual movement. But people will let you know who won. And if you lost the battle, it would be like a loss of face for however long it took you to get your skills back up and go back to that person.
Did you enjoy being in these battles?
Battles were definitely fun, and battles were what made you want to work harder. You know, you see somebody, even if you weren't in a battle, if you were watching a battle, and you saw somebody and you say, well, you know, I've been practicing for, let's say, you know, 2 months. I haven't been out in a while. I'm coming out to see what's new, what the other brothers are doing in terms of new moves. And you think you have it going on. You think, well, I got my stuff together and I'm prepared. And you see some guys doing some stuff and you know that, wow, if that was me, I couldn't handle that. So you have to go back and work harder. So a battle was almost like a midterm, but it could be daily.
Right.
And every time you'd have to, it forced you to be very real with yourself. You have to check yourself. And again, you didn't have to see a battle to know that you had to do more work. You could watch a TV show and just see other dancers or get videos. Now a big thing is people watch videos of dancers from all over the world because, again, it's worldwide. And you see guys in Europe. You see guys, of course, in the West Coast was popping and locking. Incredible. Unbelievable. So you say, man, you know, I still have work to do because you never know enough. You never know it all. And there are people who, like, we have a term in the lab. You might be thinking, well, you know, I'm pretty good at this. But there are people who are in the lab working out hard by themselves. And you have to sometimes go back in that lab and create and come out again fresh.
Now, I know your parents had a dance company. I believe it was like an Afrocentric dance
group. Right. It's called Africa One Dance Theater.
So did you learn African dance before doing hip-hop?
African dance was around me before popping and locking. I would go to the company's rehearsals and sit and watch them. It sort of sunk into me. And I think what African dance showed me and gave me was energy, raw, powerful energy. A lot of my movements are very dynamic, very strong. And I think the energy that I saw in African dance helped me not only in popping and locking, but just in terms of movement. I think it's a great base. And I want to say also my family is very supportive of me getting into popping and locking, into dancing. Anything
Were positive? They supportive early on, though, when you started doing it? Did they think it was a legitimate form of dance?
No, they thought it was legitimate. My mother might have thought I was practicing too much. But, you know, I knew that in order to be good, because I knew what guys were doing, and I knew that I had a lot of work to do. She was definitely supportive. And, again, it got to the point, I'd be working on a move, I'd be like, Mom, you know, tell me what you think about this move. You know, I'm doing a wave into a shoot down and a W, and she'd be like, okay, well, that part was good, but that part there, you look like, you know, you didn't extend it fully. So she actually would help me and tell me certain things that she felt I could do more powerfully or, you know, how to make the attack more sharp or things like that.
Run through for me some of the most interesting places that you've danced or some of the most interesting opportunities dance has brought your way.
Okay. There are many. I think the most interesting would be when I was in Africa in a few years back. sometime in the 80s, we went to Abidjan, the Ivory Coast. It was also very interesting to see how far hip-hop dance had reached. Now, of course, it had been in Paris before then and London and all over the world again. But seeing the response we got in Africa, seeing the dancers who were doing unbelievable stuff and not saying, well, they were doing African dance and a little bit of popping. No, they were popping and locking, but in ways that you could see their influences, their historical dances, they mixed it, and it was unbelievable.
Do you ever worry about hip-hop and popping being passé, becoming passé?
No, never. And I'll tell you why. I'll try to keep it to 1,000 words or less. You see, when in the 80s, when we had the first resurgence, or the first exposure, I guess you'd say, of the dancing element, the media at some point and people did say it was passé. That's why you saw it sort of disappear. A lot of people stopped doing it. People who would go, well, I took a hip hop class today because it was a trendy because it was a trendy thing to do, were now saying, well, no, hip hop is that's yesterday's thing. It's over. I think it survived that. I think, again, a lot of people did stop, but I feel those people, their hearts really weren't into it, or they had other personal areas they wanted to explore.
Do you or any of the people that you dance with worry about getting too old to keep it up?
No. I think in the course of us doing this show, we do 8 performances a week. And I think it is the most physically demanding show off or on Broadway. And I think if you saw the show and you saw we do 8 nights a week, I think you'd agree. I think irrespective of age, I mean, there's going to be a definite point when you're not going to be physically able to perform as dynamically, as strongly as we do now. That's just human nature. But I know I will always dance. I mean, I might be 85, but I'll still maybe just throw a wave, you know, just for myself, just to keep that element, that aspect alive.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Adesola Osokolumi, a.k.a. D. Incredible, is dancing in Jam on the Groove, a hip-hop review nearing the end of its off-Broadway run at the Minetta Lane Theater. It will tour in the fall. This is Fresh Air.